So, man, this, we're in a fucky situation right now.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Fingers.
Yo, this is Vector.
Hey, everyone, this is Days Ahead.
And I'm Nitroid. You're listening to the Kojima Frequency.
You there, Nitroid?
Yeah, I'm just trying to overcome the malaise of this all.
I think everybody's got a feel that now. We're like a week in. It's like day seven.
Quarantine day seven, yeah.
Fuck.
The toilet paper is running thin. As thin as our hopes.
It's weird because we ended up buying stuff early, and like nobody gave a fuck. Like I remember seeing like old people buying like, one lady in particular bought like 8 12 packs of Diet Mountain Dew, and like my first reaction was like, oh, she ain't gonna make it. but not, and then like
she ain't gonna make it, but she's gonna be wide awake.
And then I came back the next week because there was a 2-for-1 sale on Captain Crunch, and everybody was like losing their shit. I couldn't believe it.
I had a box of Captain Crunch recently. I was very disappointed. I wish there was a way I could get into a time machine and go back to the original recipe. This is a travesty.
I don't remember being as mouth-cutty when I was a kid.
It was way more mouth-cutty, in fact, which is why they changed it and made it all soft. The original Captain Crunch would never get soggy.
I haven't had Captain Crunch in a long time, though, so...
Yeah, well, they had to change it because kids don't know how to eat, apparently.
I did do something kind of insane, though. You know how they sell those bags of just cereal marshmallows that you can get standalone?
Yeah.
Well, I bought a bag of that, and then I bought a box of Oops All Berries, and I mixed them together.
Nice.
Okay. Right.
And that was probably the most irresponsible cereal I've ever eaten.
How's your diabetes treating you?
Yeah, right.
Was it any good?
Yeah, actually, but you know, like half a bowl and you want to kill yourself.
Right. Yeah. See, I like Lucky Charms the way it is. You know, I feel like there's a good balance between the just overloading sugar, the marshmallow, and the like lightly sweetened cereal.
What would a Metal Gear cereal be?
Welcome to the cereal podcast. All cereal, all the time.
Gonna try and steer this shit back around.
Are we gonna serialize this podcast?
I don't know. I'm starting to wonder. Has that ever been done? Like real, for real? Has anyone ever done a serialized podcast before? Like, what would that even sound like? You just pick up the discussion from last week.
Oh,
I'm kind of picturing like a radio show about what's going down during events of Metal Gear. So it's like a local Alaskan radio show that's like, we just heard an explosion north of Shadow Moses Island. I don't know.
So, you know, a radio show, that format might not be too bad, but we'd need like stupid radio sound effects and live call-ins.
Which I'm all for. I love live call-ins, but
just like backcountry Alaskan folk. Like, with these crazy government conspiracies about what's happening on Shadow Moses.
All right, yeah, let's do it. I mean, I got people on my Discord server that I'm sure would totally be into that.
How would we even do that, though? Like, logistically speaking, I don't know how you would do it.
Step one, don't. It's a funny idea, but it's, you know, I don't think it's worth the effort at
this
point.
I was just responding to the question. I wasn't thinking of logistics.
I just wanted to make a cereal pun. That's what I was doing. But
anyway. Oh, yeah. Gotcha. All right. No, you. That was excellent. Very well executed.
Yeah, everybody's kind of seen that meme, I think, where it's like, all right, Kojima, like, funny story. But we're kind of living.
I haven't seen it. Am I the only one who hasn't seen it?
I guess.
Okay.
The gist is that Death Stranding is kind of right.
I've seen I've seen some memes now, especially after Kojima was talking about all the rumors about a horror game. People are like, don't make the horror game. If Sony gets Silent Hill, don't make it Kojima, because they don't want it to become true.
I swear to God, if he gets another thing right. I was so just... I wonder, like, if he has a sort of tempered satisfaction. I don't know what the right word would be to all of this. Like, on one hand, you know, there's a global pandemic, but on the other, I was right.
Yeah.
What exactly was he right about?
It's not really, but the meme is the, you know,
broadly, I mean, I get the meme.
Yeah,
right?
Broadly speaking, we've got a giant global crisis that's caused everybody to retreat and isolate themselves. All the while, we're very politically divided, and now we have to rely on delivery people who are seen as heroes to bring us our things.
And if you haven't played Death Stranding, then it's got, there's a, like when you go to deliver stuff, you don't meet the actual people like face to face. You meet like a little hologram of theirs, and they're like, oh, hey, thanks for bringing my shit. And then, you know.
Right.
And then there was the guy
in
China.
And now Amazon Grubhub, they're doing like contactless deliveries where they'll notify you when a package is shipped, like do some sort of disinfectant procedure. Sorry, go ahead, Nitroid.
Well, did you see the picture of the guy in China who built like a pod to carry his infant in?
Yup.
And like, was that actually like inspired by Death Stranding, or was it just serendipitous that he made it like that?
And does it have air holes?
I mean, I really hope so. Yeah, I definitely see the parallels, but I mean, the difference is that in Death Stranding, people isolate themselves like by choice because there's no government, and in this case, people are isolating themselves because the government is kind of, they're not exactly forcing people, because here in California, there's more people outside now than there were before they initiated what they call a shelter in place. Is that what they're calling it where you guys are?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, everyone else is just calling it a quarantine.
But the amount of Instacart orders are up.
Yeah, this is something. But, I mean, yeah, I don't think, to a certain extent, I believe in coincidences. And if Kojima were to do a horror game, it definitely wouldn't come true. Especially if it's Silent Hill, because there's just no way you're going to see, you know, melty walls and a dude with a metal triangle bolted to his chin. Yeah, I think you're safe, so don't worry about it. But at the same time, I really don't think Sony is actually planning on acquiring any IPs from Konami. That would just be some weird alternate universe
stuff.
Yeah,
that seems very odd for a rumor.
I mean, I guess stranger things have happened, right? But maybe they haven't.
I can't see them buying it because...
What did Bluepoint do? Like, when they did stuff, did they just went through and, like, bought that IP?
Like, no, you don't usually buy IPs outright like that. What you do is you license them, or you have some sort of agreement with the IP holder to develop for them.
Right. I'm pretty sure... You mean like the remakes that Bluepoint did, right?
Yeah. Which, I, you know, Sony owns Shadow of the Colossus. Like, that's a first-party title. So they would just go to Bluepoint and say, hey, work on this. And then same with Konami. They would grab a, you know, they would reach out to Bluepoint and say, hey, work on this. You get some of the kickback. We get some of the kickback. You know, it's outsourcing development to a third-party studio. That happens all the time. But
is Bluepoint connected to Sony in any way, or are they just an independent that Sony...
They're independent,
because
they do all kinds of stuff. It's like their entire business model is just remaking and remastering games. They did Turok. They're working on a System Shock remake.
This is still distinct, though, from licensing an IP. You know, this isn't the same thing. Like, Konami going to Bluepoint and saying, we're doing an HD remaster of Metal Gear, we want you to develop it, that's not the same as Bluepoint saying, we want to license the IP from you so that we can do what we want. When you license an IP, then, you know, given some restrictions and rules that you have to follow, you're making something on your own.
But could Sony come in at that point and then just be like...
Well,
like
that's
Blue
the question.
Point at that point? Like, could they be Konami's Blue Point?
Well, that's
so
the question.
It's important to distinguish between what a publisher is and a developer. So, like, a company like Blue Point, they develop games, and they're independent. They're not yet. You know, they might get bought up later on, but they're not owned by a publisher. Sony, as a games publisher, they're technically competing with Konami. So the only way that Sony would be able to develop a Metal Gear without doing like some kind of cost sharing or a revenue sharing thing like they did with
Spider-Man.
That would be crazy, but I don't think that's ever happened before where you have two companies working together to share revenue. The only thing I can think of are the guest characters that show up in Mortal Kombat or Smash Brothers. I'm sure those respective properties, wherever the character comes from, the owner, they get a share, or they might get a flat fee. That happens, like the way gun licensing deals work in games.
I don't know if it's fair to say that Sony, I mean, if we're being distinct about Sony as a publisher being in competition with Konami, then I guess that's kind of broadly true. But, you know, Konami is producing software for Sony's hardware. So at the same time, they're actually kind of work. It's strange how this all works sometimes.
Well, you know, Konami, they don't want to make console games right now. They're stuck on mobile and pachinko and health spas. Because again, we talked about this in previous episodes. Like it's all about profit margins. Developing games for consoles, just it costs too much money for not enough of a return.
There's not a return. There's not a high enough return on it. Which is why
makes it make even more sense to like put the other developers on it and then just be like, okay, yeah, it's our IP still, but like y'all can do all the work and shit.
Yeah,
that's kind of how I'm looking at it.
This is where the idea of them if Sony licensed out these IPs so that they could produce games on their own, then essentially they are bearing the weight of the cost of development. When Konami reaches out to, you know, as per my understanding of how this works, if Konami reaches out to a developer and says, hey, we want you to do this, typically Konami is footing a significant amount of the bill. But if a company comes to Konami and says, we want to license this IP, we're going to pay you so that we can use this, then they're usually the ones footing the cost of development overall.
Right.
And I don't see Konami ever selling those IPs because as recognizable names, they are valuable even if they're not developing games for them.
Right, exactly.
But they could put a lease out.
Yeah, right, but if they license them, then it suddenly makes a lot more sense because they don't have to get into console development and they get kickback off of it and they get to keep their name recognition.
It kind of reminds me of like Spider-Man and Sony in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just mentioning that, or I was trying to allude to that, because there's only two ways that Sony would be able to make a Metal Gear, a Castlevania, or a Silent Hill. Scenario one, they purchase the IP outright from Konami, and that would be millions upon millions of dollars. We're talking about $100 million deal. Or they do what Nitroid said, and they license it, you know, for a couple game deal, or they sign a contract, you know, two games over the course of 6 years, and you know, and then they split the profits. But Konami isn't able to have another studio develop a game for any of those three IPs without paying the studio, because you have to pay for the, you know, the personnel, the salaries, health insurance, and all that. And that's the thing that Konami doesn't want to do anymore. They don't want to have a giant AAA studio, because it's just the figure that gets quoted these days, it's $10,000 per person per month on average. So, you know, that tells you how expensive these projects can be.
That's not counting, you know, R&D things that aren't related to just base salary.
Right. No, that should be included, because your base salary, you know, at tops is going to be like $5,000. Let's say you're making $60,000 a year on average. Yeah, so $10,000, that's per month, per person, that's to keep the lights on. That's, you know, all the overhead, health insurance, everything that goes into keeping a single person hired. And that's what a publisher has to pay. So Konami is just like, yo, we can hire a team of eight to develop a Puzzle and Dragons clone or, you know, match three games all day. And, you know, it's just the profits are the comeback or whatever you call it, it's way higher than dumping $80 million into a game for
they
market.
They did, you know, whether you believe them or not is beside the point here, but if you take them at their word, they said they weren't getting entirely out of console games development. They were just leaning away from it.
True. Good point, because they are still making Winning 11. There's no way they could go without their flagship soccer game.
So it's entirely possible that there is some Metal Gear project in the works right now that we just don't know about.
True, yeah. But at the same time, it doesn't take a lot of effort to remake a sports game.
Yeah.
You know, so you can update the textures a little bit, you know, change the lighting or a shader or two, and then you're just updating the roster, changing some stats, and you're essentially just releasing last year's game with a couple enhancements. So, yeah. So of course they're still gonna make that series, but I don't see them making a Metal Gear or a Silent Hill for a very long time.
So let's assume for a minute that there is some truth to this rumor, not necessarily in Sony buying the IPs, but let's say licensing.
Yeah.
It's kind of hilarious and kind of sad that there is any sort of potential that Kojima could end up having to direct another Metal Gear game.
Yeah, that's why I really hope this doesn't happen.
It's like he finally got away. Now they're gonna Sony comes a knocking and is like, "Hey, that studio we bought for you, we're gonna need to see some return on that."
Right.
Pay the piper.
Yeah, no, I think that would be terrible. I hope this is just an unfounded rumor and it dies by the wayside very quickly. Like just like that Metal Gear Solid Zero garbage.
I mean, it did say, like in that article, it did say that Kojima would be involved in, you know, the Metal Gear and Silent Hill things if they get the rights. But then when I go to click on that link that we had both seen for that, it's now gone. So they might have gotten some kind of...
Oh, that's interesting.
Does not exist.
I wonder if he could even do Silent Hills now. If he did, it wouldn't be the same thing by any means. Because it seems like a decent chunk of that got recycled into Death Stranding, but it's hard to say how much.
Like what?
Well, definitely
besides the Norman Reedus model.
Yeah, definitely having Norman Reedus in it, but I don't know. It's hard to put into words, but I get the feeling like maybe some of the themes he was trying to touch on might have ended up in that. But I mean, it's hard to say because we didn't really know much about PT, and then, you know, even in that they said, "Hey, this isn't really representative of what we're going to do with the final game."
Right.
Wasn't Junji Ito lined up to do designs for it as well?
I think he did. He actually did, like the baby in the sink. I think that was his design.
That definitely looks like his work.
Right. Yeah. Me and a friend were at a comic shop a couple weeks back, and they had this shrine dedicated to Junji Ito. And I'm going to be that guy. I don't see the hype. I mean, I think his art style is great. I think he's a very talented artist. But listen, I was born on Halloween. Horror is my entire existence. So I kind of have really high standards when it comes to scary stuff. And like, I'm hoping people can recommend some good stuff that Ito's done, because I haven't really been affected by his artwork in terms of like, you know, finding it scary, if that makes any sense.
I've seen a lot of his art, but I haven't read a lot of his stories. The one that always stands out to me is probably the one that everybody's read, which is the one with the holes in the mountainside that look like human shapes.
Yeah.
I feel like Ito really kind of excels when he has buildup. So, for example, with the Cliff comic, he, you know, there was all that buildup to the final artwork where right. You see kind of what happens when you go through the hole. Whereas if you look at the artwork independently, it's just kind of, okay, this looks a little bit weird.
Right.
And Japanese Japanese horror in general is a lot more subtle. It doesn't really do a level of shock value that Western horror seems to have.
Just like jump scares, like...
Yeah.
I hate to, like, reduce Western horror down to jump scares, because there's obviously way more than that, but that does seem to be a lot more prominent.
There's gore. And
right.
I mean, I guess it's more, it's maybe it's more Lovecraftian. You know, when for the whole story where you'd go through the hole and then you get all messed up. I thought the pacing was weird because they kind of reveal, you know, what happens way too early. And so by the end, you're like, oh, well, here's something that I've already seen. And it's like meant to be this huge scare. But, you know, I think he played his cards too early in that story. And so that's why, like, him being associated with Silent Hills, I wasn't really excited because I played Silent Hill 2 when I was really young. I want to say I was about 12. And like, there are sections of that game, like there's one room that you go in and there's nothing in there. There's no item, or there could be, like something that's really important, but I couldn't stand to be in that room because of the music and the atmosphere. That's what made me afraid. It wasn't a jump scare. It was just the tension created by the song that was playing. And it was a completely insignificant room. But, you know, like, that's what Silent Hill is to me, because that's just the, I don't want to say it's a fond memory because I was horrified, but, you know, like, it takes a lot to make a Silent Hill game. And I didn't see what it takes in Junji Ito's style from what I've seen. And I'm sure there's something out there that would blow me away, but the stuff that people keep recommending to me, I didn't think it suited the Silent Hill tone.
I mean, PT scared the fuck out of me. Like, just like you're talking about, yeah, like the having like the tension of going forward, like as many times as you went down that hallway, each time it was just like something a little different. Sometimes not even, but you know, you just kept going. And I don't know, I feel like with the technology we've got right now, like where graphically we have games, like, I don't know, I feel like we can create some awesome horror games right now. And we can really like fuck with people with all like the glitchy type effects, like when Lisa first grabs you and it's just like the sudden thing. You know, I think that made everybody in the world jump pretty much. But
what I have seen with Junji Ito's stuff always seems to kind of lean more into rural settings and folklore. And so I think that maybe that was kind of where they were trying to go with bringing him in on Silent Hill.
Okay.
It
makes sense, I guess.
It always seems to focus on like small communities and how they deal with these bizarre existential situations.
Right.
So in that way, I can kind of see it fitting, you know? But I mean, he wasn't being brought in to do the story. He was just being brought in to do the art, right?
Right, from what I understand.
And I was wondering if they were going to bring in, like, was there ever any word of them bringing in Akira Yamaoka, for example?
No.
I don't recall that.
Because he works for a Grasshopper manufacturer now. So
right.
Yeah, so he's off of the project, unfortunately. I like his work. But
he's done work with Kojima in the past, though, which is interesting.
He has, definitely.
So and I wonder if maybe they would let him out for a little bit.
I'm sure they could, you know, because as a musician, I don't think he might not have a contract with Grasshopper. So I feel like that's totally possible. He didn't do any of the sound work for PT from what we know. But,
other than like the theme song at the end anyway.
Yeah, I think Del Toro was writing and then Kojima was directing and then Ito was doing the like character designs and things and you know, they were trying to assemble a dream team. But the thing about dream teams is that they never work. So yeah. I mean, find me a successful dream team in history and I'll shut up.
I mean, the dream team.
The Rat Pack.
I do think it was a case where a bunch of names were thrown in and people are hyped around that, not really understanding if they would blend well or if the context would work well in a Silent Hill game.
Right.
And then to Fingers' point, one thing I really did enjoy about PT was, both in terms of gameplay and aesthetics, you felt lost because, if you guys remember, progressing through the demo was like kind of, in some ways, meta, but ultimately confusing.
It was a social exercise in part, too.
Yeah.
It was. And That is when I feel scared in horror games, is when I feel like I have no direction to progress, so I am stuck in this horror that I'm immersed in. And, you know, with the technology we have, Kojima could have probably put us in several scenarios where we felt lost and confused and needed the support of each other to get through the levels. So, yeah, I don't know.
Hmm. I feel like, too, they could have it as like an extra for like an app that you could download for your phone while you're playing one of these games. And, it could be just as expansive as like a VMU for Dreamcast. Like it could, be doing all kinds of shit. But it could also just be like another creepy element to it.
Oh, yeah.
Like a radar or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I know that Steam lets a few places or lets a few games use their interface to do like creepy shit. Like I think Pony Island, it sends you messages by your friends. I wonder if Sony would enable him to, fuck with some UI elements. I don't think they'll let him look like the game would crash, because I know they wouldn't let Undertale do that.
Yeah, Sony's got that stuff on lockdown.
But at the very least, get a message from a friend, like a glitchy message or something crazy like that.
See, I'm worried if he ever does revisit the horror idea, is he going to lean into VR? Because the plan was to take PT and make it a VR game eventually.
Really? I didn't hear that.
They were testing it internally. Cool.
Right.
And I think Kojima said it was too scary for him to even play at points, something like that. I don't remember the specifics, but they were testing it in VR, which sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Nah, it sounds fun. I would have given it a shot, but I thought PT was... It was super scary. It was horrifying for the first 12 minutes, the first time Lisa grabs you, and then it never happens again. And then you loop through the hallway another 28 times. And after a while, the hallway stops changing and everything becomes predictable. So I never made it through that demo. And if the entire game was based on that, like trying to rely on rumors to... Because there was one rumor where it's like you had to speak into the PlayStation microphone to get through the demo.
You do.
And, well, some people do, some people don't. It's like random. I've seen people get through it on YouTube without speaking into the microphone. And that's so strange. I don't know. Yeah, I know. It is strange,
right? I was under the impression that they even pulled the code out and were able to see, it looks for audio.
Well, yeah.
It could also people, do something where it would be like, if it detects a mic, then yeah.
Right.
But if you don't have a mic, then no. Oh, if it doesn't detect a mic,
then yeah, it won't lock it out.
Like, think about Metal Gear with the mono TV scenario.
Right.
Interesting.
So I'm curious, what is a good horror game to you look like? Like, what do you think is the pinnacle of horror in games?
Oh, I don't want to say the pinnacle, but that's an excellent question. I thought I'd be a really big fan of The Evil Within, because I'm like, all right, Shinji Mikami, the literal creator of the survival horror genre, he's coming back to do one last game, and I was really disappointed by that. But the sequel, The Evil Within 2, was phenomenal. I cannot overstate my satisfaction. That's a Portal reference. There you go. Just had to throw that in there.
I've heard that, too.
Evil Within 2 was really good.
I only ever played the first one, and I could not stand it.
It's very mediocre.
I can sum it up in one specific element that just turned me off to the whole game.
All right.
So, in Resident Evil, the shtick there, I hate to put it that way, but the idea in a Resident Evil game is that, in terms of resources, they give you just... barely more than what the average player would need to survive the game. So as long as you're not screwing around, you can make it. If you make relatively smart decisions, you're not going to have too hard of a time. It's realistic. Right.
Are you talking about the new games or the old games?
The older games.
Okay.
The Evil Within tips that needle in the other direction. You have just... barely less than what you would need to survive.
I completely agree.
And so you can never relax. You can never just kind of catch your breath, and you're always on edge, and it never feels like you've got a grip on the game or the situation you're in. And that's not fun to me.
Yeah, speaking of Resident Evil, the original Resident Evil 2 is a masterpiece that might be probably my favorite survival horror game. But, I make a distinction between... survival horror, because that's its own genre, and then just like games that are meant to be scary, like like Amnesia or Outlast. I don't consider those to be survival horror games, right, because you're not managing any resources. Mm-hmm. You're just running away.
I don't really like those.
Unless you're managing your own personal water supply, because you're dripping sweat into the controller. So I mean technically that's a resource, but it's not a game element. You get what I mean? That's you staying alive and not dying, literally. So the original Resident Evil 2, I think is great. Silent Hill 2, as I mentioned earlier, is a brilliant game. From what little I've played of Silent Hill 3, I really like that.
How about more modern?
Evil Within 2, I think, is about as modern as I can get. I didn't think the Resident Evil 2 remake could even hold a candle to Evil Within 2. I thought Evil Within 2 was vastly superior to the game that's supposed to be the king of survival horror games. So
one that I really liked, and it got kind of long in the tooth and it's far from perfect, but I really, really enjoyed Alien Isolation.
Okay, I can totally see that. That game did look amazing, and I did want to play it, but I never got a chance to.
They stuck to the visual style to a fault in that game.
Right.
Isolation is what I wanted out of that like Outlast Amnesia genre, where it was like a greater, more powerful enemy, but you have a fighting chance. Not a great chance, but a fighting chance. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The alien behavior in that game is just nerve-wracking. It feels so authentic. It's just unbelievable the way it stalks you. Now, it occasionally cheats, and there are videos online that talk about how they design the AI, and it actually has two AIs working in tandem, one that always knows where you are and one that doesn't. And the one that knows where you are gives hints to the one that doesn't, so that it knows the general area you're in, but never exactly.
Right.
So it's kind of cheating, and sometimes it'll get you in unfair ways, but man, it's just, that game is a heart attack simulator.
So it's like Pac-Man?
Kind of. A
little bit, yeah.
What about
you, Fingers? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's a mode in the game that you can turn on where if you've got a PlayStation camera, you can lean left or right to peek around corners. But also it pays attention to ambient noise. And if you make too much noise in real life, it alerts the alien.
Very nice. They did that in Manhunt like a decade ago, too.
Oh, did they?
If you had a mic and you hooked it up, it was optional, but if you had a mic and hooked it up, if you made noise, the other convicts could hear you. And I was going to say Manhunt might have been one of the examples, too, just from the sheer brutality of it all. And that's another game where, like, you don't stand a great chance. It's a stealth game where you don't stand a great chance, but you stand a chance nonetheless if you play smart.
One last thing. I this is my, like, my pipe dream, and it will never happen, because I from what I understand, the Alien Isolation team has been mostly disbanded. But I wish those guys had made a Jurassic Park game.
Oh, man.
Now, see, now you're creeping up on my answer, because I was going to say a new Dino Crisis.
Oh, man.
Some of these guys. Yeah.
Please.
I'm a huge fan of the Dino Crisis series.
They're going to put like a Regina costume in the RE3 remake, and it's going to make me lose my fucking mind.
I think I saw someone already did that.
Oh, of course they did.
Yep.
I'm a big fan of the first two games in the Dino Crisis series.
It's exactly what I was just going to say. Yeah.
I think that's next in line after, right after RE3. You know, they're already working on it. I actually saw, I went back and looked back. I made a Tumblr post back in like 2014. I was like, they need to make a new Dino Crisis game.
But you gotta like really figure out what you want your Dino Crisis theme to be. Because after the second game, it went way the hell off the rails. Dino Crisis 3, like dinosaurs in space. And it's a sci-fi game. I mean, it was always a sci-fi game, but like you have a jetpack, you know, it was just weird. Just really friggin' weird.
Broken completely.
Yeah, it wasn't a good game at all. So if they were going to do a new Dino Crisis,
just remake the first, just, yeah, give just the, Give the first one a fucking remake.
Lean hard into horror.
Right. Yeah. And then you have Dino Survivor. Anybody play that?
I did not. That's the rail shooter, isn't it?
It's not on rails, actually. It's you know, the GunCon 2 controller that Namco had made for Time Crisis 2, my favorite arcade game of all time. It had a D-pad on the back. So in Dino Survivor, you actually use the D-pad to move around, and you have tank controls like in Resident Evil, but it's all in first person. And then when you actually, I think, there was that, what was that? Resident Evil Survivor game on PS2.
Dead Aim. That was awful.
It was called like Gun Survivor.
Dead Aim. It was Dead Aim. That was awful.
Yes, right. That game had a similar control scheme where, like, when you see an enemy, you go into first person and then you use the light gun. But then when you're done shooting, you move around the environment.
Man, Resident Evil Survivor, there's a game I haven't thought about in a while.
Ugh. That was a great Blockbuster rental for me.
Yeah, like, it was one of those games you rented, and you're just like, at least it's only one weekend.
Yeah, I rented that, and you know, about 20 minutes later, I was like, wait a minute, did I beat it?
Oh, man. Yeah.
I wonder what they're going to do next, though, if they don't do Dino Crisis. That seems to be what everybody wants Capcom to remake next, because they seem to be in full-on remake mode, but I hear people saying, like...
A lot of the diehards want Code Veronica.
I'm one of those diehards.
Needs a facelift. That needs a facelift the most. Steve Burnside single-handedly needs a facelift.
Yeah, we need our Steve back. But there's also like a really vocal group of fans who want them to remake Resident Evil 4, and I know that's been out for such a long time, but it still feels too new to remake to me.
Yeah,
you don't need a 4 remake.
Yeah,
at all.
But imagine if they did, and how many copies of that they would sell.
They've already sold... I already have 8 copies of Resident Evil 4.
Yeah, Resident Evil 4 is like the next Skyrim.
It would go crazy. Yeah. Here's my problem if they do... I know we're so far away from Metal Gear at this point, but...
I'm going to bridge it back.
Remaking Resident Evil 2, whether or not you liked it or felt that it was a good remake or not, it was in some ways justifiable. Not as justifiable as RE1, but still justifiable.
Okay.
Making 3, if you look at Resident Evil 3 compared to Resident Evil 2, 3 was enough of a departure. The original Resident Evil 3 was enough of a departure from the original 2 in that they added Nemesis and dodging and some choice mechanics. And like it was supposed to be a spinoff initially, but there was enough differentiation there that you could say, okay, it's not just 2 with a fresh coat of paint. There's enough different here to set it apart.
Right.
And that extends to a remake. So Resident Evil 3 remake has Nemesis in comparison to Mr. X. They've added dodging. They've thrown in a slightly more open world, it seems. So, like, there's enough to differentiate it there. You know, it's not just RE2 remake with another coat of paint. It's got enough there to make it unique. Code Veronica's big change was that it had 3D environments. But apart from that, it was just another Resident Evil game. So remaking it, like, what is going to be the differentiating factor there? What is there to set it apart from the 2 and 3 remakes?
So they brought the dodging mechanic back into this 3 remake I've seen in the trailers. I have the demo installed, but I haven't had a chance to play it yet. But they definitely have the dodging. They might have the choice mechanics in there.
They don't. They got rid of them.
They do. Or no, the dodge mechanics they kept.
But they got rid of the choice?
They don't have the choice in the demo.
They got rid of the choices. There was an interview where they talked about how that's not going to be in the new one.
Okay,
I'm fine with that. You know, yeah, fine. But Code Veronica, like, you don't have dodging. I think the biggest feature that Code Veronica brought to the RE table was the insane amount of backtracking you had to do. So. Yeah, unless they do a Dark Souls-like thing where you can open a door and then it turned out to be the hidden passage that gets me back to the starting area.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but I love Code Veronica, and it's such a flawed game, but something about it is just fun for me.
And I think that's why hardcore fans want that to be remade the most, is because it seems like it's a cult classic, it seems, in terms of the series, but it has so many little blemishes that people kind of want to see it at its full potential.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the only Resident Evil I haven't beaten, like, just because of it just, like, frustrated me.
Yeah, it can be unfairly hard at points.
And there, you can like, totally screw yourself and, like, not be able to progress.
Yep, I think I did that a lot of times. There was this, like, one enemy type that, like, once I got to that point, I was like, I can't fuck with this thing. It was, like, a reptilian type thing that stood on 2 feet.
The Bandersnatch?
I don't know.
But those things, I thought you were talking about the worm that would come. I hated the worm that would come out of the ground. Because you could lock the... There's, like, a shutter that you can get locked out of, and then there's no way to open it.
My buddy's copy on Dreamcast originally had a glitch during one of the boss fights, and it was like only on his copy of the game, because he could easily beat it on his buddy's version of it, but every time we would load it up on his, and that part, it like would not progress. It was with that, I think it was, does Steve become like a big human bat or something like that at some point?
No, he's a giant axe.
He does become a giant Hulk dude with an axe, yeah.
Yeah, and like
not a bat,
instant kill on you or something like that. Like it like just kept clipping my body. Like no matter what,
the encounter with him is basically just run and try not to die, and just consume herbs constantly because there's no way to really dodge him. Yeah.
There is a way, actually. It has been done, because me and Fingers' friend Nurse Psych, he was streaming the game, and you know, there's a tutorial on YouTube how to get through the Steve fight without taking damage, and it is possible. I watched him do it.
All right, I got to look that up later.
I know it's nuts. Anyway, so since we've spent some time talking about horror games for a little bit, you know, thinking about the horror games that you like, and then thinking about what that playable teaser was, you know, how do you see that playable teaser transitioning into an actual game? Because if there was an entire game built around those mechanics, and I know it was just a teaser, and it's not even really a demo, but there's not really a game there, so it was hard for me to be excited about that project because I wasn't sure what the final product was going to look like.
Here we go. Multiple hallways.
Boom. All right. No, I'm still not going to give you $60.
Lots of rusted doors.
Resident Evil 7 was a pretty good like example of what you can do in that type of give the guy a weapon. Like, okay.
Okay. But yeah.
Only like enough to like, you know, not be a badass with it, but you know, you're still pretty vulnerable in 7 until a certain point.
Right, right.
But yeah, just
7 actually might have been my game of the year in 2017. I love that game.
Yeah. 7 is, I know, we're getting kind of far away, but 7 is a really interesting game, especially if you play it in VR. I waited to play 7 until I could play it in VR because I wanted that experience, and I'm so glad I did.
My one regret, going PC VR instead of PSV 4 VR.
So
I don't regret that.
If Sony does get this this license, what do you think we would want to see them do with Metal Gear if they did do something?
Man. Yeah, great question. I would have to think about that.
The ideal scenario for me, and this has nothing to do with the actual game, is that they get some creative guidance from Kojima Productions, but they like Kojima is only involved to the extent that he wants to be.
I always get the feeling like if he had another chance to come back, he I know he says he wants to get away, but part of me feels like he almost can't help himself. And that he would end up doing it again, even if he had a choice?
I don't think he would.
You don't think so?
But that's, I mean, if it were my decision, I would keep him as far away as possible. I wouldn't want him anywhere near it.
I'll tell you what I think is likely versus what I would want to happen. I think we're probably going to get a remake of some kind, either MGS1 or MGS3.
Okay.
Less likely would be maybe remakes of Metal Gear 1 and 2, because people have been clamoring for that for God knows how long.
Right.
Less likely than that, I think they would either do the Metal Gear Solid 0 or 6 or whatever, like some sort of official continuation. And then what I would like to happen is drop the canon altogether and just do these weird little one-offs like James Bond or Final Fantasy, where they just kind of, you know, experiment with the formula and have new stories and they don't tie themselves to a canon and just do whatever they want.
Ooh, that sounds sure, good.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm all for that. And also explore other genres. I want a Metal Gear Kart Racer. I want a Metal Gear Match 3. I want a can we get it like a truly open world Metal Gear? Because it's never been done before.
Give it to the XCOM devs. Let them make one.
Oh, yeah, sure. They could do... I have a feeling they'd wind up doing Metal Gear Acid 3, though.
See, I think that's what we need. Like, if they do a... like some kind of strategy game, just take away the cards, just make them units, you know? Yeah, exactly. Just like XCOM. Yeah.
Do like a Sons of the Patriots, like a real-time strategy game where you're like, you know, Battlefield Control, you know?
Yeah. Hinted at, you know, in, in Peace Walker and the Phantom Pain, like all those little mini games, pretty much is all it came down to. But, you can take all those vehicles and have some big battles and then deploy a Rex in the middle and just fuck shit up.
There was, there's a piece of fan art that's been going around for ages, and I can't remember the name of the artist, but it's easy enough to find. It's like a feudal Japan version of Metal Gear where you see Snake as a samurai hiding behind some barrels.
Oh, and yeah.
Love to see a game made out of that piece of artwork.
They did that with the Phoenix Wright, the Ace Attorney series. Like, it was a feudal Japan playable novel. You weren't playing Phoenix Wright, but you were playing, like, the ancient Japanese version of him.
Oh, that sounds cool. And I know they did it with... The Yakuza series
did it, too.
Yeah, Yakuza, I was about to say.
Yeah, there's a precedent for that, but I don't know. I feel like Metal Gear is rooted in contemporary issues. So, like, if you take away, like, the modern-day issues of society, and then you have to try and make it about, like, oh, here's what people cared about 400 years ago. Like, I don't know if Metal Gear works in that case.
I mean, with some of the issues, sociological issues that seem to repeat in history, could you maybe propose a game that maybe doesn't hit on those issues directly, but maybe uses them as a metaphor for contemporary issues?
Yeah, you know, after I said it, you know, I realized there's tons of things that you could do, you know, like you said, things that repeat in history, and, you know, like those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. So, and at the end of the day, MGS3 was a period piece that was, you know, 60 years ago at this point.
This is where I wonder if they ever would, if they ever do touch the canon again, do you think they'd go even further back? And I really hope not. I hope they just leave the canon alone.
No, we still need a Cobra Unit game. It's gotta happen at some, in some alternate history. You know, I want like a Rainbow Six style squad based World War II Cobra Unit game.
Or you could do something like some sort of a third-person MOBA style where you're playing as the various Foxhound bosses and everyone's got their own unique abilities. Like, imagine playing as Psycho Mantis.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't want me to ever play it, yeah, make it a MOBA.
That's... Hey, I'm not saying all these ideas will stick. I'm just throwing them out there.
I mean, there's two genres that I can't stand. MOBAs and the Battle Royale genre. So...
Well, I meant more in like the style of something like Overwatch, which I know that's kind of a stretch to call that a MOBA, but it's definitely MOBA inspired.
Oh, I get what you're saying. That's more of that's what's called a hero shooter.
Yeah.
I still think that's a great idea, though. I would play that. And maybe I would dabble in Metal Royale, because why not?
I'm surprised they didn't.
What about just some boss missions?
Some boss missions?
Some old technology, you know what I'm saying? Just like basic... Just like a game that's full of just like good stealth missions where you're doing these, you know, operations back in the day as the boss.
I was going to say, I would not mind another sort of anthological, I can't pronounce that word, VR missions.
Yeah, I missed that.
Mm.
VR missions in VR.
Oh,
okay.
God.
I get what you're saying. Okay. Interesting.
That would look dope, being in that, like, space. Like.
Side note, I've tweeted Namco once a month since, like, last year, asking for a VR Time Crisis. They haven't responded, but I feel like I'm making progress nonetheless.
Oh, that would be a blast.
Would it, though?
Time Crisis is how I learned about gun recoil, because at the arcade.
Yeah.
Or not gun recoil days. Necessarily, but just like that the slide moves back.
I just really like VR shooters.
12 years old.
Yeah, because I grew up with Duck Hunt, and Duck Hunt, you used to hold that bitch like right up next to your eyeball, like to look down the scope.
I used to hold it up to the screen.
Look down the
That's
sight,
why you got to get Hogan's Alley, man.
Yeah.
Hogan's Alley?
Yeah,
For a second, I thought you said Gorgonzola.
the gun slide at the arcade just went pow and hit me right in the eyeball. I was just like, oh, God.
Oh, God.
I didn't know that the thing had action to it. I was like, what the fuck?
I've never seen anybody do that.
Like, I kind of flinched away, like, you know, immediately, like, as it was doing it, but.
I'm so sorry you
grew up on that
deal
duck
with
hunt
that.
With that right up on it aim.
There was a rumor going around for a while, and it obviously didn't have anything to it, but everyone was expecting Konami to do like a Metal Gear Battle Royale game at some point. You remember? For a brief period of time, everyone's like, oh, they're going to do this. They're totally going to do this.
I'm down for Metal Royale.
And I kind of wish it would have, you know?
I mean, yeah, you totally could do that. You could even do it in Metal Gear Online 2. You know, you have the infrastructure already to do it. Metal Gear Online 3,
you could totally do that. Yeah. 2 actually had a mode that was similar to it with the shrinking map and everything.
Oh, yeah.
So they
kind of play a lot of 2. I played more of a Metal Gear Online 1 than 2, but.
Did anybody have that mechanic before MGO2 where you know, it was last man standing and then after a certain amount of time the perimeter shrinks?
Well, the Battle Royale genre. Wait, say that again, Days?
I was saying the original movie.
Yeah, no, the Battle Royale genre literally comes from the book Battle Royale, which got turned into a movie. So
right.
Yeah, so that book, I think, came out in 99.
Just mean mechanically in a game. Did any other game do it before MGO2?
Well, I was going to say the reason I said that was because I feel like there was the technology was not there until around MGO2, I feel. So while the concept existed, you know, other than maybe like a mod that I might not have been aware of back in the day, I feel like there was no way logistically that could be done.
Do you know what that game type was called?
I think it was like a stealth deathmatch.
Stealth deathmatch?
Yeah. Where every player had stealth camouflage on and a basic amount of weapons, and it was last man standing, and if you waited long enough, then the map started shrinking in, and if you went outside the perimeter, you took damage.
Huh. I mean, I had no idea that MGO2 had that.
Yeah, and but, I mean, you know, 16 players and fairly small maps, but some of them were big enough that it was pretty tense.
Yeah, that would have been, 2009, 2010? Yeah.
Around there. And then you didn't really know where it was going to shrink to either. So it had that same, like, it's going to enclose, but you don't know where it's going to end up.
Right.
So in a bigger map like Outer Outlet, you know, it was pretty crazy.
Oh, here we go. Check this out. Blah, 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 staple multiplayer action games, fewer total players as early as 1990's Bomberman, which is also a Konami game. So, Bomberman.
That feels like a stretch.
Well, here, let's see what it says. Introduce multiplayer game modes with players all starting with the same minimal abilities, collecting power-ups, and fought until the last player was left standing. And I feel like there were totally Bomberman game modes where the map shrank over time. I remember there was one time
rocks falling and making like the grid smaller.
Yeah, I think there was one Bomberman version I played. Like the bombs actually delete sections of the map. So I mean, it's
that's kind of wild.
You know, yeah.
He pulled it technically.
Yeah. No. I mean, hey, Konami invented it. So actually, I'm sorry. No. I take that back. Hudson was purchased by Konami, so that was a Hudson game.
Go Hudson.
Yeah, Hudson was, they were badass back in the day.
I do think there is some validity in maybe exploring, like, I forget what the right term is, but like asynchronous online play. So did any of you guys play like Spies versus Mercs on Splinter Cell?
Hell yes.
Yeah.
So I did not.
Okay. So to kind of break it down, it was like, if I recall correctly, and Vector, keep me honest, it was like a 2v2 type mission.
Pandora Tomorrow.
There were two types of teams. So there were two teams. There were the Mercs, who had this very limited first-person view, but they had weapons. They had pretty substantial firepower. And then there were the spies, which played like Sam Fisher, where, you know, they could be taken out pretty easily, not too heavy of firepower, but their utility is, they have far more utility, so they can get around places. They can, you know, avoid the vision of the guards pretty easily because of their first-person view. So it was sort of this asynchronous gameplay, or this asymmetrical type of gameplay, where it was two completely different play styles. Some maps were advantageous to the Mercs, some maps were advantageous to the Spies. I'm not sure if MGO had anything similar that was, like, as asymmetrical, but...
It didn't, I was going to say Spies versus Mercs, it actually was directly inspired by Metal Gear Solid. The Mercs first person view was meant to replicate the cone of vision, that you'd see in the Soliton radar.
Oh, that's so funny.
The closest thing that MGO2 had to that would probably be the team sneaking, I would think, where you've got...
Actually, yeah.
Where you've got one team of guys who have no stealth camouflage and are mostly fully armed.
Right.
And then you've got and they're protecting a target. And then you've got another team that all they have are knives, tranquilizer pistols, and then one type of usually support grenade, where it's either like a scanner or smoke or something.
Yeah, it was just lethal versus non-lethal, pretty much.
Right. But they have stealth camouflage. And so, you know, one team has to take out the other, or the stealth team has to...
There's two objectives normally.
Right, right. So, I mean, that's kind of in the ballpark.
Yeah, I did play that on MGO3 a lot, but having it first-person view was, like, the big thing on that Splinter Cell game. I do remember that game mode now.
It's interesting to look at how Splinter Cell approached stealth after Metal Gear, because there were inspirations there, but Metal Gear's always had sort of like a caricature of stealth, if you know what I mean?
I think I do.
Where Splinter Cell went kind of hard, like all the way on realism as hard as they could.
Right.
Paying attention to things like shadows, which is something that Metal Gear never really did too much of.
Right.
It's always like stealth in Metal Gear is always abstracted to some sort of a numerical value that the player can see. And while I'm sure that exists in Splinter Cell, it's obfuscated. So you feel like it's more realistic.
It's very analytical. I was going to use analytical, but that's a way better word.
Yeah, I guess in Splinter Cell, you have a slider, which technically is numerical, but then it's represented on screen as... you know, this bar that either shows if you're in light or darkness. The mechanic comes from the Thief games, which had like this, it was an icon at the bottom of the screen. You were either in shadow or you weren't, but Splinter Cell had it changed it so that it was a gradient value. So, you know, like if you were a little bit illuminated, then guards would you know, they could recognize you. Like it was a lot like the camo index, honestly. There's really, I'm thinking mechanically, there really wasn't a difference, except the only camo you have is black. So, and then the level design was structured so that, you know, you had to hide in certain places to get the optimal camo index. But now that I'm thinking about it, like, it really was the exact same thing as the camo index. And I'm wondering, because I know the camo index came after the original Splinter Cell, so I'm wondering if there was any influence or cross-pollination there.
Well, MGS3 had a Splinter Cell joke in it. Actually, had a couple of them, if I remember right.
In the game or in the MGS4 teaser trailer?
There was one in the game that I can remember, and it was the in the snake versus monkey mode where... Campbell's telling Snake that he needs to go and capture monkeys, and Snake's like, well, can't you tell Sam or Gabe to do it?
Oh, that's right. I remember that. Okay, good call. Good one.
So, I mean, Gabe, they were aware of each other. Gabe would set the
monkey on fire with his taser. I can't stop thinking about that taser.
Oh, that's genius. Gotcha.
That was a fun mode.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I wish they could have brought it back for the HD remasters.
Maybe that's what Sony's working on. It's new
Ape Escape 4?
Yeah, just a new Snake.
Snake versus Monkey or Ape Escape?
Snake versus Monkey.
Did you ever see that crossover went both ways? Did you ever see the Snake cameo in the Ape Escape games?
I saw a screenshot, but I never played those games.
Yeah, I think it was Ape Escape 3, but there's a Metal Gear type mission in it where you play as one of the apes holding like a banana gun and dressed up as Snake from MGS2, and then
right.
And then Solid Snake shows up at the end and like congratulates you, and it's got like a different voice actor though. It's not David Hayter, and it's really weird.
Yeah, I wonder what the business deal was like. You know, it's like, hey, we'll put our character in your character in our game if you scratch our back or something.
Right, and there was a lot of things like that that are just like
Assassin's Creed, Creed Monster Hunter. I think one of the Monster Hunter games might have had like a sneaking suit in it, and then you fight Rathalos.
I love that mission on Portable Ops.
I can't remember if it was Monster Hunter Tri or Freedom Unite. I think it was one of those two. My wife would know. She's like an enormous Monster Hunter fan. But but you could play as, like, there were skins where you could play as Snake in the battle armor or the boss.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. And then Peace Walker had Rathalos, which was a lot of fun.
I feel like Rathalos is everywhere nowadays.
It had a T-Rex as well, and then there was the Gear Rex, which is one of the coolest things they've ever made.
Yeah. It complete with Railgun.
Yeah, there was, if you look in the art book for Peace Walker, that fight's unfair as hell. If you look in the art book, they had concept art for a Gear Ray as well.
Man.
And it's pretty cool looking. Have to dig that up and show you later.
See, that's like, at the end of the day, there's so much like potential for Metal Gear. It can go like all these different ways. It can just be like applied. Like it doesn't really have to be a continuation of canon. You know, it can just be like a thing, a universe where cool shit can happen.
On that note, I hate to bring this. I hate the whole George Lucas Kojima comparisons, even though I somewhat agree with them. But I feel like this is a good example of it, because I feel like Star Wars, it's so much untapped potential. We just need to broaden its horizons, not centralize it to one leader or one company or one director.
And you see that Shinzo Ogiri, when he got a hold of the franchise with like the Acid Games and Ghost Babel. And
exactly. And to that point...
Are you talking about Tomokazu Fukushima? Who are you talking about?
So Tomokazu Fukushima did writing. Shinzo Ogiri did the game direction.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, I see what you're saying.
But it's proof that if you get the right people, you can make really good Metal Gear that's not canon and not Kojima.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree.
And to the point, back to Star Wars, is like you can make a good Star Wars / Metal Gear game that doesn't have to focus on, you know, Snake or primarily stealth or, I guess in the Star Wars metaphor, Jedi. There are plenty of different stories you can tell.
Kojima-san doesn't have to make Metal Gear anymore.
We could have an Ocelot game. You know, you can take like so many different characters.
Rising is proof of that.
Yeah. An Ocelot dating sim, but it's about you betraying different governments.
So it's like an anti-dating game?
You gain
someone's trust and you got to level up your charisma. And then at the end, you shoot them. That's brilliant, Days. I'm serious. I really mean that. That's a genius idea.
All right, I'll start the Kickstarter tonight.
You know, so I that's what I would say. I feel like stealth always held Metal Gear back. It was like, if you're only allowed to do stealth, then, you know, that's that kind of is what ran the series into the ground for me. Like, look at God of War. God of War started off as a third-person hack-and-slash game, and it evolved into a third-person shooter. Like, there's potential there.
I appreciated God of War through all of its stages. But
yeah, me too.
I see what you're saying. Game. Like, it turned into something completely different by the end of, you know, by where we're at now with it.
But it also didn't seem like a betrayal of what it had been up to that point.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on who you ask.
Yeah,
I definitely see your point.
By the time you got like the twin blade things, that's when it started feeling like the old God of War again. Then you're like, okay, I'm not just throwing my axe back and forth.
Yeah.
How is Konami going to be so hard on going into mobile games and they're not going to do a Metal Gear Acid gotcha title for iPhone? Like,
yeah, I feel like they could now. On. I mean, now that you mention that, there's no way they're not going to steal that idea.
Please, Konami, if you ever hear this, free. Steal it, please. You have my legal permission. Just do it.
Yeah, here's your useless starter deck, and you can buy new cards for only $4.99 each.
I will go broke so fast playing
the that. Solid Snake deck is like 50,000 points, but also $60 to give mobile gamers a sense of pride and accomplishment when they earn Solid Snake. Or I guess it would be Big Boss. An
interesting question. What would be the currency of the Metal Gear like mobile universe?
Probably GMP.
GMP.
Like GMP. But it could also be like, you can 50 gold bandanas to unlock this this Meryl card.
Because you've got your base currency and then your special currency.
Yeah. it could be rations. Gold rations.
Yeah, there you go. I would seriously go broke so fast.
You run out of rations when you run out of, like, plays, but you can buy a calorie mate to refill your rations.
They'd have to license that all over again.
Dude, if this really happens, though, like, 2020 has already been pretty shit. If I have to, like, spend all my Doom prep money on a Metal Gear gotcha, that'd just be, like, the cherry on top, really.
I mean, I don't think it would happen anytime soon. So, you got plenty of Doom prepping you can do.
After Metal Gear Acid 2 did so poorly, I can't see them returning to mobile. I don't know how Social Ops did, because that was kind of a quasi-acid, wasn't it?
Never played that one.
Me neither. Well, it didn't come out here, and you had to have a Japanese account, and it was just, I never got a chance to try it out, and then they took the servers down. There's footage of it, but even watching the footage, it doesn't really make sense.
Let me take a look. Yeah, Metal Gear Social Ops.
Yeah, it's the one game that's kind of a blind spot for me.
Let's see. All right, looks like you get a screen. There's some buttons on there. There's Mei Ling.
Even Metal Gear Arcade, I got a chance to kind of dive into, but this was something else.
It does not look fun. So,
what about a new iteration of something like Metal Gear Solid Touch, where it's like shooting mechanics?
That was not a good game.
I'm saying, but like, what if they like did it well?
Like shooting galleries? There's your Ocelot game right there.
Cover mechanic and shooting, basically. Basically Time Crisis, but with Metal
Gear rail shooter.
What about...
No, that should be your Ocelot game, and you have like an old-timey Western... Call it
Time Paradox instead of Time Crisis, and then you're good.
Gray Fox, okay. Fruit Ninja.
That would work.
That was basically all Rising was.
You've got Raiden, and you've got the
yes,
the
it was...
Fucking
I discovered how to before Steam supported it. I discovered how to interface my DualShock 4 with my computer so that I could learn how to slice and dice on Rising for the PC. I couldn't do it with the keyboard and mouse.
Yeah, I use a 360 controller for Rising on PC. I recommend it. It's good.
But there should be more genre bending games like Rising. That was just a absolute blast, and not as much. There are some fans who are kind of scoff at it because it's not traditional Metal Gear stealth gameplay. But most people seemed pretty warm to it.
I mean, the people that like it, you know. Yeah. that's my favorite Metal Gear game of the entire series, but it's specifically because it's different from everything else that came before it. And it's also possibly the best told story. And I'm not saying it's the best story, but it's the best told story in the entire franchise. I mean, that's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it. Just like
delivery-wise?
Yeah, that's going to require some justification there.
Well, that's a separate episode, but no, right,
that's fair.
I do think Rising kind of refuges in its audacity. It's so extreme. It's so balls to the wall that, you know, you kind of appreciate it.
What other genres could you get into, though? I'm wondering if, like, could you make a Metal Gear RPG?
That's what I was just going to say. I've always wanted to see a Metal Gear RPG. You know, there's several ways it could be done, and I know how I would do it. And Nitro, you gave me a couple of good ideas, but, you know, because I do that. I do, like, hypothetical thought experiments where, you know, if I were to make a Metal Gear RPG, how would I do it? And I think there's a lot of ways it could be done.
Yeah, I don't know if, like, traditional old-school turn-based would work necessarily. It might.
Right.
But there's possibly quite a bit more you could do, especially with action RPG mechanics.
Yeah, definitely. And there was that new Ghost Recon game, which I guess is being reworked into a Splinter Cell game. I don't know if anybody saw the trailer. Sam Fisher's back. And I'm glad, because I really like Michael Ironside. He did a great job as Sam Fisher. But they turned Ghost Recon into a loot-based RPG like Destiny, and it didn't work because they didn't have their formula right. But, you know, they did it right with the Assassin's Creed series. So I feel like you could easily do the same thing with the Metal Gear universe.
I just, when you guys started talking about Rising, I just distinctly remember a time in, like, 2012 when Rising had been released on PC, and then all of a sudden, like, all the Metal Gear forums I went to were, like, full of these Platinum fans who were like, who the fuck is Kojima? I'm not mad at all. I S-ranked this mission without a white suit. Fuck you.
Huh.
That's funny.
Well, yeah, I wish they would do a Rising 2. Make that the RPG. Do Rising 2 and then make it an RPG. Or more of an RPG than Rising was. Because, you know, you had some light elements in there.
So just have, like, skill trees with, like, different moves, and you can, like, focus different stances and, like, make it more like a Neo-type game or something.
Ooh. Yeah. I want to see a Metal Gear that leans harder into urban stealth and adventuring and exploration, and even like having conversations with NPCs, like get more into espionage, like actual espionage, where you have to build relationships with people and get intel and not just sneaking through from A to B.
Boom. There's your Ocelot game right there.
Hey.
Yeah.
We got about three Ocelot games here.
He's just, that good, you know, of a character.
That's the takeaway.
Did I tell you guys he's the actual star of Metal Gear? Like, he's the main character. The story of Metal Gear is about him. All of it. No? Nobody with me on that?
I could not argue with that.
You know, I can't argue with it because I can't
approve or deny it. I can hear somebody, like, furiously writing a letter right now.
Yeah, please do. No, like, think about it.
Right. Didn't they already do that in the comments of that video?
Probably.
Which video?
Didn't you make a video?
Oh, I totally did. It's dead now. But I mean, some people were on board, like 50,000 people. But you know, it's you've got the sorrow and the joy, and then so the joy, she sacrifices herself to, you know, save her country, and then, like, you have Zero and Big Boss, and they both misinterpret the boss's will, but they actually don't, and it's weird. You know, they just, like, it's more out of spite for the other that they, like, purposefully misinterpret the boss's will. And then you know, Ocelot finally rectifies the whole deal and puts both Big Boss and Zero in their place and is like, no, this isn't what my mom was trying to do. And, you know, because he's in every single game of the main series. Everybody's following his lead, and he's making everyone think that he's like the loyal, you know, right hand man. But then he winds up shooting everybody in the end in the back because he's got his own plans. And so it's you know, the Metal Gear saga is Ocelot's hero's journey. That's boom, mic drop.
See, there was a telling moment in that where you said he's in every one of the main games, which betrays that you don't really consider Metal Gear 1 and 2 to be main games, despite being the cornerstone for this entire franchise.
But his presence was there, though.
Retroactively.
It was retconned in. Yeah, it was retroactively, but that's the thing. It was retroactively inserted because he was that important. If he wasn't important...
Not to go back to the Star Wars reference again, but it kind of reminds me of how, like, Palpatine has kind of de facto retroactively, like, the series has been about him.
Right.
Because they fucked up the writing on that.
Yeah. I mean, hey, you want to talk about fucked up writing? This is a Metal Gear podcast.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely influenced the whole series, like, throughout, like, the most. You could say that. He's probably, like, the most influential person.
I don't know.
But you know who else?
Yeah, like you said with Palpatine, that, like, they made him the, you know, like, I am all of this. It's like, okay, well, shit. Okay. That kind of changes
things. Am I alone in thinking he was more interesting before he had all of this importance thrust into his character?
Not at all.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
Not to go back to Star Wars. It's kind of like Boba Fett in a way, and Jango Fett. Like they were good in that they were, they stayed their welcome, and the more details you get about them, kind of loses the lore a bit. I don't know.
That's right. Also how I feel about Big Boss, because
exactly. I thought you were gonna say MGS4. I was like, no, not again.
No, we'll have an episode dedicated to me going off on that game. But when Big Boss, they started to develop him out and make it this... When they started to recontextualize Metal Gear as being more about Big Boss than Solid Snake, it started to kind of lose me a little bit, because he was more interesting as this shadowy figure that you only knew through innuendo.
And not, exactly.
And once they started fleshing him out, I mean, it was interesting. Metal Gear Solid 3, you know, really justified everything that he did, but then as they... You know, as more and more got added on, and, you know, the mystique just faded away.
And to that exact point, someone else, the very important character who also wasn't in Metal Gear 1 or 2, who turned out to be one of the most, if not the most important character in the series, the boss. So, yeah.
I know I said I wasn't going to go into MGS4 here. But I think the thing that I didn't like about MGS4 that still kind of turns my head a bit was that it was poised to be a game that was about Solid Snake and the end of his story. But what we got was yet another extension of Big Boss's story. It's just Solid Snake walking through it. You know, he's sort of walking through the rubble of Big Boss's life. That's MGS4.
So, you know, someone mentioned fucked up stories a couple seconds ago, and here we are.
I promised myself I wouldn't do this.
But it does feel that way. It feels like Solid Snake is reading through, like, the Wikipedia or the Cliff Notes of Metal Gear Solid 3, and they're like, okay, now you need to solve all this shit.
Right.
Right,
and how does he solve it?
Someone else's mess.
He's going through the wiki and being like, no, no, no.
I hate it when that happens. It's happened in Blade 3 as well. Still makes me mad.
We don't talk about Blade 3. but I like the idea of comparing Blade 3 to a Metal Gear game, because it's about, you know, in terms of storytelling, they're on the same par, same tier list.
Well, I said I'd do Star Wars again.
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with comparing Metal Gear to Star Wars, because I think in a lot of ways, for a time... Metal Gear was the video game industry's equivalent of Star Wars until, I guess, Mass Effect came along. And when it was, like, very obviously trying to be Star Wars without being Star Wars. So, anyway. But, no, yeah, I don't think it's a bad comparison at all to make. And it's one that everybody can get. So, if you have more Star Wars analogies, by all means, let them fly.
I'm just trying to think of more franchises that kind of had a similar swan song of just utter extravagance like MGS4 did, where it just tries to square every circle to a fault.
I mean, the Star Wars
yeah,
fucking prequels. The prequels are exactly that. Like, I mean, that's literally the nanomachines and the parasites of 5 are the midichlorians of the Star Wars universe. It's the explanation of this mystical thing that you like to just think was cool and magic, but it's like, nope, it's science, bitch. And I think Ocelot, you know, says it in 2, you know, there's no such thing. So it's just, you know, I kind of like that fact that they keep reminding you that it's not really magical. It's like, no, this is under control. This was kind of planned and rigged from the start. Like, even in Portable Ops.
But I kind of hate that.
When they say that it's like, oh, it was awesome. I mean, but it kind of shows you that it's like, you know, at the end of the day, we kind of are under people's boot or, like, under some kind of control at some point, you know, at least for our surroundings.
But you lose the mystery. And I just want to point out that it's kind of ironic to hear that there's no such thing as miracles or the supernatural, quote, coming from a guy who literally in the last game spent a lot of time around a psychic.
So going back to your point about Metal Gear Solid 4 feeling like Solid Snake is kind of going through the motions of Metal Gear Solid 3. I felt that way with the entire prequel trilogy. Like, okay, here are these new characters, or here are these characters you're supposed to follow. Here's them going through, like, Star Wars, the OG trilogy lore. They had no development themselves, like...
Right.
And then Palpatine, aka Big Boss, is arbitrarily thrown in the end.
Is Palpatine Big Boss or is he Zero? I feel like he's more Zero. And I then like Darth Vader is Big Boss.
Yeah, Darth Vader's Big Boss, because Darth Vader in Star Wars in the original trilogy was just kind of... He was a villain that you learned had a connection, but they never really went into what got him there, you know, beyond a surface level.
Right.
And they both don't like committee meetings and shit.
Right.
And they both show up at the finales and just, like, wheelchairs.
Yeah, and then the prequel movies make it all about him and this long, complex attempt at reconciling how he got from A to B.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, Darth Vader's totally Big Boss.
And, like, and so, like, after the trilogy, after the prequel trilogy came out, I remember a lot of fans saying, well, actually, Star Wars isn't about Luke Skywalker. It's the whole saga is about Darth Vader.
Okay.
Okay. Here's a gold star, buddy.
I can see that argument.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it's wrong, but it's also not, like, completely factual either. I don't know. It's a headcanon at best.
Yeah, but it parallels to what I see in Metal Gear circles of people saying Metal Gear's actually Big Boss's story. And I hate the idea of these cool little tales that take, you know, elements of magical realism and politics and science fiction and throw them together into something that's just an amalgamation of movie references and crazy, you know, fever dreams.
Right.
And they try to turn it into lore and into this, it was meant to be this, and it's this sprawling narrative that, I hate that. I hate when you try.
I completely agree.
I hate it when somebody takes something that's really interesting and tries to and creative and tries to codify it.
You don't have to explain everything, and that's actually a huge issue with Star Wars, is that fans need an explanation for everything, and so now everything is over-explained. Right. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Red Letter Media video, like 10 facts about Darth Vader's suit, and it's like the most mundane shit. It's funny, but it's mundane. It's one of their best videos. Those guys are great. That's how I felt in Metal Gear Solid 4. Like, I'm learning these things that didn't necessarily feel relevant. I don't know.
And I didn't want to know them. Maybe I thought I did, but I was wrong.
Right. Well, I'm that kind of, I used to be that kind of person where it's like, if you're going to tell me about Darth Vader's suit, I'm in. If you're going to tell me that a lightsaber is actually a loop of plasma, and that's why it's like, it's not a solid blade. It like goes out and comes back and stuff like, you know, and there's a gyroscope in it, and that's why you have to be so skilled to use it, because if an untrained wielder will, it'll fly out of their hands. I'm into that kind of thing, but. You know, I understand that, like, you, those are things that can be saved for, like, a sidebar or a codec conversation.
That's what I say. So you like the technical codec conversations where they just, like, explain a weapon and, like...
Absolutely. Like, I listened to Natasha rant for hours. Harasho, good, you found a sulcum.
But
I love
weirdly,
that.
None of that seemed to detract from the rest of the story.
Yeah, exactly.
So you just don't like
and
it on an
thing.
Overarching thing where it's like where all the characters right. and everything is tied together necessarily.
But yeah. then when you right. get to like MGS4 and Big Mama is telling you about how the support team from MGS3 was actually behind every major global event from the past 50 years, and you just, like, I just wanted to throw the game out the window. God.
Yeah, I think if that's something that you're into, it shouldn't be a part of the main plot. It should be there for the people that are interested in it, but don't make it the focus.
I felt like it kind of was at that point, because it was just like this quick mention. Like, that didn't make me go, oh, screw this.
It needs to be the salt on the dish. You don't want to just eat a spoonful of salt.
Yeah.
Can I just say, I also loved, you know, because of my own ethnicity, I love how he was like, okay, Signet's black. The DARPA chief's black. They're the same guy.
Okay, like, okay. I get on that note, end of Metal Gear Solid 3, you're looking at the timeline and it says that Sigint joins ARPA, which, right. you know, is responsible for ARPANET and then later becomes DARPA. And so at the time, there were conversations and forums where people were like, oh my gosh, I wonder if Sigint is really the DARPA chief because he worked at ARPA. And most other fans who were, you know, trying to be reasonable about it were like, more than one black dude works at ARPA.
Like, right.
No, they're not. Just stop it. And then we get to Metal Gear Solid 4, and he's the fucking DARPA chief.
No, I get the sense that Kojima planned that. You know, he's like, hey, let's do a prequel and have the DARPA chief. You know what, the person he was before he became the DARPA chief.
I guess I would accept it a little bit more, because it does make sense, especially with that timeline. I think I would accept it a little bit more if everything else didn't feel arbitrarily connected. So rather than it being like, oh, it's a cool tidbit, it felt like he was pulling it out of his ass to fit with the whole, like, connecting
exactly.
part.
Yeah, because then you get to the whole Dr. Clark thing, and... You know, I mean, Naomi does say that, you know, she didn't really know that if it was a man or a woman in MGS1. And then
but it's that everyone has to be everyone else, and everybody has to be related or connected to something. Like, it's all interconnected and everything's a complex web, and just things can't exist in isolation. And I hate that.
But if you do look at Sigint, like, he does know his shit when it comes to weapons. So
yeah,
it's like,
Sigint's awesome.
What would he do with that kind of job and knowledge? It's like, okay, I guess I'll go fucking work up the, you know, the advanced weapons research. You know, they got a good budget, shit. You know, like, I got my qualification. You know, like, that. To me, it doesn't seem so outlandish. I can see, like, yeah, Sigint's like, oh, it's the one guy. But to me, like, that progression, you know, like, it connects. So it's there. Then when people say, like, when they see Drebin, they're like, is that his son? It's like, ah, oh, all right, now come on.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
Speaking of Drebin.
That's what I'm saying, like, that, you know.
Right.
Have you ever seen the Drebin boss backstory generator on the Snake Soup?
Yes.
No.
Which is one of the funniest things ever, where you enter, like, and like, okay, pick an animal, pick an emotion, pick another emotion, and it auto-generates a Drebin story, and it's like, you know, so-and-so was, you know, stalked by wolves as a kid, but then would always hear wolves howling, and then one night woke up to find all of the evil people in their village dead, but it wasn't a wolf, it was actually them.
Whoa.
But it wasn't a wolf. It wasn't an animal. So it's like Mad Libs.
Yeah, it was like a Mad Libs. Yeah.
Nitroid, I was gonna say if you're into mysteries that you know not being revealed, we still have no idea who the Wiseman's Committee was.
Hmm.
So they didn't explain everything.
Bunch of old white dudes.
Pretty much.
The impression I got was that it was really nobody. It was all fake information.
Well, see, that's the cool thing, is that now you can guess as to what it can be because there's no explanation for it.
Yeah, but I also kind of don't care.
Exactly.
Oh, so. And I was going to say, part of that mystery, too, in not connecting those things is world building. It's like, if you connect everything, there's no, like, lore. There's no, like, surrounding world to exist with these stories. So I feel like that takes away from the impact of said stories.
The more you interconnect every single element, the less the world around and outside of these elements seems real.
It's isolated. The Metal Gear is exercising social distancing because it's the story is so isolated.
Although I do wonder who the benefactor was.
We'll never know.
Because
apparently that question wasn't important.
I guess not.
But the fact that Sigint had a dream where everybody was covered in shit, that's very important. Take note of this. This is going to be important.
I can't believe that conversation got it into the game. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, some people are going to be like, what? Because there's some people that have only played the HD remaster, and you only get that conversation after waking up from the nightmare,
right,
which they took out. Now, there's what we need to have an episode about, Snake's Nightmare, or Guy Savage, as they call it.
Or Zone of the Enders 3, as it was almost.
No way. I had no idea.
Yeah, the Guy Savage engine was a prototype for Zone of the Enders 3.
Holy damn. See? That's amazing. Man. That was like the best playable teaser. Forget PT. Guy Savage.
For a long time, there was speculation that that engine made it into another game called Nanobreaker. There was also talk that it had been recycled for a Castlevania game, but I don't think either of those ended up being true or just didn't pan out, or I don't know.
Yeah.
It was a good engine, though. Savage. Played well.
Yeah. Oh, I wish I could play it again, but I'd have to break out my old copy.
There's a topic, though, sometime for a future episode, Zone of the Enders 3. Man, that hurts.
Yeah, absolutely. We should absolutely talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Okay, closing thoughts?
I got nothing. Yeah.
I need to pick another movie to compare Metal Gear to, or another movie series.
Oh, I got one for you.
Blade Runner. Please say Blade Runner. Just kidding.
No, this is an obscure one. It's called Gunhead, and it's you can find it all over. I think it's almost in the public domain at this point.
I was gonna say Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Perfect.
Hey.
You're sneaking around, you know, trying not to get seen.
Well, I will say this. I don't know when we end up talking about, like, stature or police dots, but I have been going through the Super Best Friends playthrough of Police Knots. Jonathan, man, he's a guy. He's a character. Yeah,
he is a man.
I've got a bunch of notes about all that shit, so I'm looking forward to it.
We're going to file some paperwork about that, gentlemen.
What kind of paperwork?
Kojima's I don't like paperwork. Him back.
the kind that gets you called into HR.
Are you talking about the fact that he almost bangs his daughter?
That and some of the comments that he makes throughout the game. Like, you could take some of the screen
about his
caps,
daughter?
About his daughter, about waitresses, about, like, escort girls, about train attendants. You could screen cap those and put them in, like, a sexual harassment PowerPoint.
You can touch boob.
Well, it's a character flaw, right? So does he overcome it by the end of the game? Find out next time on Kojima Frequency.
Until then, wash your hands.
Wash your hands. Stay inside. Don't question.
Don't let the COVID nanomachines get you. The COVID language parasites.
Star Wars.